From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Last week's eye-opening homeless census is intensifying friction between neighboring cities. L.A. Council members, whose districts abut other cities, claim homeless residents are being pushed into L.A. The neighboring cities say that's not true. They blame L.A. for lagging in services. Let's see if we can all get along right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day started well. We have a lot to talk about in the program today. Coming up later, Southern California's important place in the evolution of the amusement park. We all know Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm's important places in that history, but L.A. attractions were around long before. We'll talk with Steven Silverman, author of the new book, The Amusement Park. That's later this hour. First, tensions are high between some L.A. City Council members and leaders of neighboring cities. The not surprising source of the bad blood, explosive growth in homelessness. We saw a 16% jump in the city of L.A.'s homeless population in the annual census released last week. The west side of L.A. was a major driver of that growth. Now, a pair of L.A. city councilmen are accusing neighboring cities of pushing their homeless residents into L.A. With us, KPCC housing and homelessness reporter Matt Tinoco. Matt, good to have you with us. First of all, when did the sniping begin on Facebook?
It began a couple weeks back, and sort of at the core of it, there's a court decision that came down from the Ninth Circuit, and the appeal was denied earlier this year, that basically says cities are not allowed to enforce laws that basically prohibit sleeping on public property. There was a court case a few years back that just finished through the Ninth Circuit called Martin v. Boise, where it was a group of homeless individuals sued the city of Boise for basically ticketing them for sleeping in public parks. Ninth Circuit said that is a violation of the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Those sort of conduct laws amount to cruel and unusual punishment. So where we are now, as you said, the sniping between local government officials, the city of L.A. says that it's compliant with the Boise decision, which means that they say that they are not citing people for sleeping or sitting on the sidewalk. Other cities around Southern California, however, continue to do that. And the effect of what the L.A. officials and other, in this case, Torrance, I think that's where we're going. L.A. says, OK, well, we're compliant with this decision, but other cities around Southern California, they're not compliant. They continue citing people and saying, OK, well, you know what? Just go to the city of L.A. They're not going to ticket you there. They're not going to enforce the laws there but we are. So the tension right now is L.A. says, OK, well, we're compliant with Boise. Other cities around the region are not compliant with Boise, which that has the effect of people gravitating towards Los Angeles because the laws here will, in theory, not be enforced.
I was looking at David Zonizer and Durrani Pineda's piece in the L.A. Times where they interviewed some of the homeless residents who were along the Culver City, L.A. city border. And the homeless residents were claiming Culver City police were kind of shooing them to the other side of La Cienega or saying, you know, you can't do it here. Go ahead in L.A. You can do it there. And those sorts of anecdotal accounts also seem to be fueling this.
There's anecdotes all the way down, I suppose that's what you could say. And also distinct the laws that say you cannot sit or sleep on the sidewalk. There's a whole host of other sort of conduct laws that can be enforced. And then also just the reality is a lot of people, because you get a citation, people miss the court dates, that turns into a bench warrant. So the effect can sort of be, okay, well, unless you comply, we're going to pick you up and enforce that bench warrant, which it's a little more abstract than just this. But in terms of the nature of how people get moved around from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, it's sort of the threat of enforcement versus actual enforcement itself.
Since I began with the Culver City example, let me bring into our conversation Captain from the Culver City Police Department, Sam Agaibi. Captain, thank you for being with us. Your response to the claim that your officers are pushing Culver City's homeless into L.A.?
Good morning. What I say to that is that we are responsive to the issue that we have. We have a problem of homelessness in L.A., not just in Culver City. And we respond to calls for service from our residents and business owners and patrons throughout the day. We get a lot of calls throughout the month. We did a recent survey of our calls for service related to homelessness. Since January to April of 2019, we've had approximately 800 radio calls of related to mental health and homelessness. Out of those, probably about 26, which is almost 3%, that ended up in citations. So most of our radio calls or issues related to that are handled with an emphasis on outreach and trying to help resolve the problem. And we understand that enforcement isn't going to necessarily solve that problem. So we have a heavy emphasis on outreach and providing resources to the homeless. We have a team that is dedicated to doing so, our mental health and homelessness outreach team. We have a clinician that is assigned to us from the LA County Mental Health Department that goes out on a regular basis with our patrol officers for that purpose. We're looking to expand that effort. That is my long and short answer to that long issue or extensive issue.
But are there any of your officers who have shooed homeless residents out of Culver City into Los Angeles? Are you aware of that anecdotal claim?
It is anecdotal. We have not received any complaints from any homeless individuals that they have been shooed away. And in fact, we get nothing but praise about our efforts from the community, from the homeless outreach committee that the city has put together. And in fact, we have a housing specialist within the city that has never received a complaint. She's on a regular basis contact with the homeless individuals in the community. And that is an entity that is outside of our department. So we have not received any complaint.
All right.
About such an issue.
Joaquin writes on the Air Talk page, my guess is Culver City's policy isn't substantially different than LA's. Their response is just faster and more frequent. So homeless residents stay away from Culver City, largely to be left alone. That's Joaquin on the Air Talk page, 866-893-KPCC, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. In case you just joined us, two LA City Council members, Mike Bonin, who represents the West Side, including Venice, and Joe Buscaino represents the harbor area of L.A. They claim neighboring cities have encouraged their homeless residents to move into Los Angeles, putting more stress on the homeless population there as well as city services. My question for you as a listener, is this something that you've observed? We're at 866-893-KPECC, Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Laura MD, who's Redondo Beach City Council member. Thank you very much, Councilwoman, for being with us. Your response to the claim that the beach cities are pushing homeless residents into LA.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. In Redondo Beach, homelessness is not a crime, and we don't treat them as such. We created a homeless task force with a 360-degree strategy, which include not only abiding by the law, but being service-based. So we contacted our neighborhood we're coordinated with our faith-based neighborhoods who were focused on feeding the homeless only at the time. And we've guided them towards helping us create a way to get a path to get them to not be homeless anymore. We also contracted our own dedicated navigator with Harbor Interfaith. We've provided extensive trainings to our police officer, and we even have a specialized team that has been working with mental health professional. And just like Culver City, we have a mental health clinician that travels with our police department to be able to help out the homeless to get them into beds where we can. In addition, in our 2019-2020 budget, they're asking for more money so that we can have our quality of life prosecutor go attend cases in downtown LA. We're going to have even more specialized programs to be able to help out the homeless.
All right. Let's.
The thing is we don't have enough beds. Is really what it comes down to, and that's a regional issue.
Councilwoman, what do you do if you have someone who has set up to sleep overnight on a city street or in a public park? What are the terms under which you allow the person to sleep on public property? What are the things that would cause the individual to be removed?
Only if they have. If they've created done some kind of a crime, have they threatened another individual? They had to have had a crime. We don't treat them as criminals. They are allowed to sleep there per the law. We do bring out an entire team of mental health professionals. We bring out PATH. We bring out our specialized police team, and we do to try to offer them the services that they need.
All right. So you do allow people, though, to sleep on the street, on the sidewalk overnight or in public parks in Redondo Beach?
We have them now. Yes, we do.
We're talking with Laura Emdy, Redondo Beach City Council member, KPCC reporter Matt Tinoco. Matt, the claim is that these cities are taking people off the street, telling them they can't spend the night there.
I think it might be, in a sense, it might be legal to sleep on the sidewalk, but it might. I don't know the specific rules for Redondo Beach or the other cities in question. That requires a strict reading of the municipal codes. But just generally how this works. So it might be legal to sleep on the sidewalk in a place, but it might not be legal to have a tent. You might not be allowed to have personal property. There's a whole host of other sort of municipal code violations that can be invoked essentially to make people. It can be invoked that effectively means somebody has to move somewhere else, even if the line of code itself doesn't say no sitting or sleeping on the sidewalk.
And is the court silent on that issue of what it means to sleep on the sidewalk? Are you entitled to set up a tent, for example? Are you entitled to have your personal belongings there? Does the Boise decision get into what it means to sleep in a public space?
A strict reading of Boise says that you can't do no camping ordinances or no sitting on the sidewalk. That is strictly under the strictest reading of Boise. That is not okay. At a more liberal interpretation of Boise, Boise uses the phrase "you may not criminalize life sustaining behavior," which that is something that would have to be clarified in the courts insofar as how it applies to individual municipalities in Southern California. But the most liberal interpretation of Boise says you cannot criminalize no life-sustaining behavior, which that's a much broader thing that might encompass possession.
Weather, so a tent that might in dry weather be considered not essential for life-sustaining might in a downpour be essential.
Yeah. And maybe there – I remember one of the attorneys telling me how there is a more liberal impression that it might actually apply to personal property. That's something that would have to be clarified in the courts. It's just right now we're talking anecdotally and it's somewhat abstract, but the core of Boise just says that you cannot enforce these laws against people living on the street because it's cruel and unusual punishment based on the premise that there is no other alternative.
All right. Let's take another call or let's bring another guest in. Councilman for the city of Torrance, Aurelio Matucci. Thank you very much, Councilman, for being with us. In Torrance, are homeless individuals allowed to sleep in public places and on sidewalks?
Well, right now we're not truly enforcing any of this. Of course, the court case from Boise, Idaho, kind of shed some light on what we can or cannot do for the future. But we did have somewhat of a stand-down approach so far.
So that means you're allowing people to stay overnight?
Yes and no. Tents on sidewalks, we are not allowing as of right now, mainly because they're blocking ADA access. But we are desperately looking for ways to help individuals into programs and truly not allowing them to just rot away on our city streets.
Okay. And what about personal belongings? Are people able to have some personal belongings with them if they're sleeping in a park or on a sidewalk? Or are those banned as being obstacles to access to those public spaces?
Well, we do have, you know, a certain leniency with certain things, like, you know, if it's personal products in a couple bags, a duffel bag or a backpack, that's not a big issue. But when they're hauling around stuff on shopping carts, we are enforcing shopping cart thing because those are technically personal property that belongs to stores. So we are enforcing that. You know, look, we do have a heart. We do feel that this is something that we need to do on a regional basis, because if not, cities like Manhattan Beach are just going to push people next to the next city over. But if we do it on a regional basis, I think it'll be a lot more effective to actually, I hate to say use push, you know, the verbiage push people into programs, but that's truly what we need to do. There's a lot of drug addiction on the street, mental illness on the street. And of course, you got those individuals that want to just live free. But there is a lot of refusal of services, and that's one of the biggest obstacles some organizations are having.
Councilman, what's your sense of the percentage of homeless people in Torrance who are from Torrance, who have a history with the city?
Very little, very few. As a matter of fact, in the last 2.5 years, we almost doubled. Now, of course, Los Angeles is going to laugh at us when we say we have a little over 200 homeless, but we're a city of a little over 147,000 people. We are relatively large. You know, we do contribute quite a bit. We have a lot of great organizations that do help out the homeless. You know, I do have a background in this. I'm the vice president of New Challenge Ministries. They're at a nonprofit that helps homeless in the area. We're based out of Torrance Post Office. It's not actually Torrance City. I've also served 2.5 years on the Social Services Commission that handles homeless and also veteran.
But your sense is the majority of the homeless Torrance residents have come from elsewhere. They're not natives of Torrance.
That's correct. And, okay. You know, when we try to track who's here, you just, I just find it almost amusing to be that we're accused of pushing people out when, in fact, our population almost doubled in 2.5 years. So, yeah, we're not pushing people out. If we did that in the past, I can assure you that that's something that a lot of cities were doing before, to try to contain the homeless into the L.A. Strip. But nowadays, I think we've corrected that. We're taking a much nicer approach, in my opinion, but definitely not a strong approach to where you're really going to entice people into programs.
All right. We're talking with Torrance Councilman Aurelio Matucci, Laura MD, Councilwoman Redondo Beach, Sam Agaibi is captain for the Culver City Police Department. We're talking about allegations from two L.A. City Council members, Mike Bonin and Council Member Joe Buscaino, who both declined a request to join us today, claiming that neighboring cities have been essentially pushing their homeless residents into Los Angeles. We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, the history of amusement parks and Los Angeles' central role in that. We're going to talk about the ostrich races, the crocodile alligator farm, and much, much more. That's coming up on Air Talk. But right now, the challenge of homelessness and squabbling between Los Angeles and neighboring cities over claims that some of those neighboring communities have been pushing their homeless residents into the city of L.A. Deborah, in Venice, you're on Air Talk. Your thoughts about this?
Hi. Well, I'll start by saying that I believe that this is entirely the fault of Los Angeles for not containing the problem to begin with. It's also the fault of the state because they have had Prop 47 and 57, early release of criminals, people who were once felons, came down to misdemeanors, and if they have $900 crimes or less, they're not prosecuted, basically, is what the police have said, at least in Los Angeles. I live in Venice, so I know firsthand of what's going on with regards to homelessness and how the police are trying to tackle the problem, but not really. So I think that our council people are frustrated, but that's no way to say now you take them when it really is the problem of Los Angeles. The other thing is this, Larry, that there's over almost $1 billion in the county from Prop 43, which was the high-income earners tax, that hasn't been touched by the state and by the county. And that was for mentally ill people. Now, for services, for buildings, they haven't touched it. And you have to ask yourself why. Because the homeless count that came out was saying that I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think about a third are serious mentally ill people that are just wandering the streets. And they are not being helped because those funds are not being used at all.
All right.
I find that rather insane.
All right, Deborah, just on the point about the police and the misdemeanors, I mean, we've talked about this a lot on the program because of that, what is it, $950 threshold for officers to go through all the paperwork and everything to write someone up for a property crime of less than $950 when the person's not going to serve any time or what. Yet, I mean, you understand where they're coming from, right? There's no return on that time investment.
I actually don't, and I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
Because it creates no deterrent. That's like saying that somebody who might have not much money, a car that costs $950 to somebody means the world to them. And for nothing to take place because somebody who is on the street or homeless or a criminal and they now consider it a misdemeanor, that's a major crime to somebody that doesn't have a lot of money and they get their car stolen just because their car is valued less.
All right, Deborah, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Culver City Police Captain Sam Agaibi, just quickly for you, sir, do Props 5747, in your view, have any correlation with rising homelessness?
Yes. Anecdotally, I could say we haven't done any research to actually show that, but I could see a correlation between the time that happened and the increase in the homeless population. And often we've contacted individuals related to a radio call or a complaint of a crime, and they happen to be homeless, and they are on one of those programs related to Prop 4757.
So these are people that might have been incarcerated in past years that now are outside and don't have a means of support or have a place to live.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Becca in North Hollywood says, I drive through Glendale and Eagle Rock every day for work. In Glendale, I don't see homeless people, but as soon as I go into Eagle Rock, 20 yards from the Welcome to LA sign, there are encampments under the overpass. I've always wondered why, and now it makes sense. That's Becca in North Hollywood. Mark in Loma Linda, you're on Air Talk.
I've traveled across the United States quite a bit. I've noticed that while I'm in the Midwest, there's individuals that'll be asking me that are homeless, hey, can I just catch a ride with you so I can go back go over to California? It's so much easier out there. There's plenty of fruit on the trees. It's just falling and rotting on the floor. What does it matter for me, right? I've never given anybody a ride, but I can tell you I've been hit up a lot. I live across the street from a VA. I watch homelessness every day. I see individuals that's got mental health issues all the time. I've got a background in nursing and also public health. And I go out and I interview and I talk to these individuals. And I see that the number one problem in this area, which it's, we've lived here for 6 years, it has more than doubled in just the Loma Linda area,
yeah,
which used to be a very small community. But now it's a lot of homelessness, a lot of drug use, mostly mental health issues that I see directly on our street.
Yeah, and it's happening in so many communities that perhaps didn't have anywhere near as visible a homeless population in the past. Mark, I appreciate it. I mean, historically, Southern California has been a place that people have come for economic opportunity or for the weather. And, you know, we've always had a homeless population here. We've had people living in Griffith Park for, you know, probably 100 years. But what's different is the scale. jail is the huge number of people. And Matt Dinoco is, as you were saying, what is it you said is 19% or something like that are from out of state?
In the most recent homeless census.
Which is still a lot of people.
It's still a lot of people. It's just it's not the majority. It's actually it's less than a fifth are from out of state. And basically the uptick that we're seeing is just people falling off the bottom of the housing market and not having the resources to get back up on their feet.
Because now if you're going to come to Southern California, the cost of living is so much higher. That's a much tougher thing than when it was more comparable to the cost of living you'd find in other parts of the country. Let's talk with Acacia in Long Beach. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Okay, so I'm with Cal State Long Beach, and I actually worked on a report on the homelessness in Long Beach, and myself and my team worked really closely with the homelessness community here and the different facilities and agencies that address homelessness. And I can tell you for a fact that many homeless individuals come from LA to Long Beach to receive services because Long Beach addresses homelessness completely differently than LA.
So it's actually a draw that Long Beach is able to provide more.
Yes, correct. We provide more services. There's a specific outreach team, a street team, that works through the Health and Human Services Department. And they go out on the streets and they outreach to the homeless individuals, offering them various services. And then they then work specifically with these individuals to get them into short-term housing, long-term housing, whatever services that they need. And then there is a specific department within the police department called the Quality of Life Officers that work specifically with the homeless individuals. As well as the HEART team, which is a specific department within the fire department that works specifically with homeless individuals.
Acacia, I appreciate your call. Matt Tinoco, it seems that a number of local police departments and cities are setting up these teams to go out and be able to triage homeless residents with needs.
Yeah, the premise of outreach is that we're going to work with people on the street to sort of get them into the system and connected to the services that we have available to them. This is done by police departments. This is done by NGOs. This is done by specific outreach teams by the cities that are not attached to an NGO, but are the city themselves. The trouble is that a lot of the times where we are right now is just there's so much more need than the help that's available. So the outreach team can go out and we can get the people into the system. But ultimately, you can do all the outreach you want, but that doesn't change the reality that there's not much to actually give. There's nowhere for people to go. That's the whole issue. We have a shelter infrastructure that is much – there's many fewer shelter beds than there are people who are outside. We don't have affordable housing stock available for these people to afford, basically. And so you can do all the outreach. Outreach is crucial in sort of bridging that trust. But the problem is that when we hear like, oh, well, they don't want to be helped. The reality is that people do want help. It's just that there's no it's a hopelessness situation because they've tried to get help. They've worked very, very hard to try and get help and try and resolve their situation, but at a certain point you just give up because nothing, your situation hasn't changed.
Well, and some people are in the throes of addiction and other people don't, because of mental health challenges, aren't really in a frame of mind to be able to take advantage of help.
Yeah, and the one thing I want to say, mental health and addiction are, it cannot be something to be ignored. I mean, it's you can't ignore it in this whole thing. But I want to clarify that, or at least in my, again, it's anecdotal, but just spending, I talk to people who are living outside a huge amount. Those are things that happen after people fall into the street, because living on the street, it's so physically and psychologically corrosive. Like, try and imagine, I want everybody, like, really try and imagine trying to sleep on a bus stop. Okay, whenever somebody drives by with a loud muffler, you're going to get woken up. You're not able to sleep. And that, do it for two nights, do it for three nights, do it for, okay, now do it a year. Like, you're just, it's not, your psychological well-being is just an active deterioration. That's what happens.
That's interesting. So many of the people that I've over the years talked with who are homeless, you know, describe on and off again battles with addiction and living with, you know, family members and friends for a while and burning out those relationships and, you know, running out of goodwill over time because of the challenges of addiction or mental health challenges, and obviously living on the streets doesn't make that any better. Matt Tinoco, housing and homelessness reporter for KPCC, thank you so much. And our thanks to our guest, Sam Agaibi, Culver City Police Captain, Aurelio Matucci, City of Torrance Councilman, and Laura Emdy, Redondo Beach City Council member. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, Southern California's central place in the development of the American Amusement Park. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies.
Let's take your car and do Amusement Parks USA.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Over the past few days, we've celebrated the start of summer by talking about where you can find the best ice cream in Southern California. Yesterday, it was offbeat or eccentric museums where you shared with us your favorites. Today, we talk about the history of the amusement park. Now, we all know the central role of Walt Disney's Disneyland and Walter Knott's Knott's Berry Farm on the creation of the more modern-day theme park. But well before that, we had amusement attractions like piers up and down the coast. We had alligator farms, ostrich racing attractions. We had all kinds of places that Angelenos would go to in search of entertainment. And with me is the author of the brand new book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them, Stephen M. Silverman. Stephen, good to have you with us today.
This is as thrilling as being at an amusement park.
Oh, thank you. I just love your book. You go back to the early European amusement parks and even the role of royalty in creating these attractions. But I do want to focus on California because we have so many attractions here in the state that have been influential elsewhere. It's not just Coney Island that's had an effect on it. So what are some of the earliest here in Southern California?
Well, and of all places, in the we're talking the 1880s. You know, this was a vast wasteland at that point. But there was a fellow from South Africa, Charles Sketchley, who started importing ostriches, really to pluck them to sell the feathers for fashion. They fetched a high price. Well, he opened a farm which he had financed by Henry Gaylord Wilshire, whose name may be familiar. Of all places, I mean, talk about karmic, it was on the border of what became Buena Park in Anaheim. This is the 1880s. And it was really strictly a farm, but people came from far and wide because they'd heard of these unusual creatures, you know, milling about and laying eggs and being plucked. And it struck him, if I charge people to see this, I'll make money. Key to any of these parks was he opened a souvenir stand.
Of course. Gotta have your merchandise.
But then started the tourist influx into Los Angeles, which was a result of the Santa Fe and Union Pacific Railroads having price wars. Well, Buena Park and Anaheim weren't that convenient to those who came in to Union. So he got Griffith J. Griffith to finance a move into Los Angeles, and that's where the Los Angeles Ostrich Farm was.
Right on the border of Highland Park and South Pasadena.
Right. Well, but then by that time, because of what he had accomplished in Buena Park and Anaheim, there were ostrich farms all over Southern California. So his quickly went out of commission. Griffith sold gave the city the land. That became Griffith Park.
So that was another one.
Clausen's in South Pasadena. They were all over. But what became sort of the central area in Los Angeles was, it's now called Lincoln Park. I grew up in Los Angeles. I live in New York now. But I must admit, I don't really know where Lincoln Park is. But that became the center of first the ostrich farm. An ostrich farm remained there, an alligator farm, William Selig was a film producer. He started in Chicago. He came out here for the abundant sunshine, but also to escape the Edison Trust. And he had – his studio was in Silver Lake, but he opened the Selig Zoo, and he shot jungle epics. The first Tarzan movie with Elmo Lincoln was shot in Lincoln Park at the Selig Zoo. He sold his studio in Silver Lake to William Fox, and not only expanded his studio at Lincoln Park, but he had plans to build an entire, and for lack of a better expression, Coney Island. And it was going to have all the rides, the Chute to Chute, which was the first key ride, even before the roller coaster came in. It never happened, and then Selig lost his main star, Tom Mix. So the whole thing got lost, but it then went through several owners, and there was an amusement park built there. It was Chutes Park with, again, the Chute to Chutes, and that was never properly cultivated or policed. It became part of a franchise of Luna Parks, which were all over the world. They were copied from the Coney Island Luna Park, which had opened in 1897. But that franchise, there's still two Luna Parks in the world back from that era, and that's in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. But that one also went belly up.
We're talking with the author of The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. If you're someone who went to one of these older attractions in Southern California, you remember the Deer Park in Anaheim that was around for a while, trying to take advantage of Disneyland's growth since families are coming here anyway. There was the Hollywood Wax Museum, 866, or Movieland Wax Museum, 866-893. KPCC 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk about the piers because that's a big part. Abbot Kinney with Venice.
They were actually, believe it or not, developed later. Downtown Los Angeles was developed first. Nobody thought to go to the beach. The first pier was Long Beach. And in fact, it's the first pier in the state of California.
Was that the Pine Avenue Pier?
It became known as the Pike. And it was around until 1968, but it really wasn't a very savory place ever, to be perfectly honest. But the Santa Monica – well, Abbot Kinney in 1905, he was a tobacco heir from New York. He'd been all over the world. He wanted to build Venice of America on the canals. He got the marshland of Venice. He got the worst land in Venice because he thought, well, I can easily dig canals. And – not only were there homes for sale there, but there was a pleasure pier, as they called them. And he had the latest rides, all the latest and greatest. LaMarcus Thompson was known as the father of the gravity ride. He introduced the roller coaster in America. It originally started in Russia. It moved to – the French put wheels on it, so really making it a roller coaster. But it sort of stayed in Europe, and he developed the notion of a switchback railroad from an old mine train. And he then developed what they called scenic railways, which were dark rides combined with roller coasters. Sort of think of the Matterhorn at Disneyland. But these were really elaborate structures.
Yeah. Or Space Mountain, one of those dark coasters.
Yeah, but you know, these would stop, so you would see – he actually had people from Broadway design the tableaus. And they were marvelous. And, you know, they would light up. And they would be air cooled if you would pass something that looked like Switzerland. They were all very imaginative. There was a great one at Venice Pier. It was eventually replaced by the Golden Age of the roller coaster because Henry Ford had put everyone behind the wheel of a car. Once Americans had their own cars to drive and they could provide themselves with their own thrills, amusement park owners had to provide super thrills. So that's how the roller coaster really came into its own.
We'll continue our conversation with the author of The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills, and The Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them, Stephen M. Silverman, and Greater Los Angeles, with plenty in this book, its influential place, with the pleasure piers up and down Southern California, the attractions that built up in advance of Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm, and of course, the first movie studio to come up with the idea of a tourist attraction was our own Universal. We'll talk about that and more at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. Stephen Silverman with us on Air Talk, and he's just sharing with me this book, which, I mean, this is a heavy tome, The Amusement Park, which is an extraordinary history of centuries of development of attractions, that he wrote it actually in less than a year because he was so immersed in it. He lived, ate, breathed the subject matter, and it's astounding how fast he was able to do this once you've seen the book. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brian in West Hollywood says, I lived in Coney Island in the 60s when I was under the age of 12. Wonderful place for summer and weekends and lots of tourists. Very vibrant and, boy, crowded on weekends. That's Brian in West Hollywood. And in Pasadena, I understand your great-grandfather had some connection back to the amusement park at Lincoln Park?
Well, not to the amusement park. He got a city concession in 1906 when they had put in the lake, and he ran the boats there. My grandfather, his son, worked one 4th of July and made $40 selling peanuts. Excuse me. And so he went home and told his dad he made a fortune in one day, so they bought the concession. And the family was in the business till the mid-60s.
He made 40 bucks in a day in 1906?
$50 on the 4th of July. It was as much
wow.
Month, I know. And so they bought the concession, and they had the Lincoln Park, Echo Park, MacArthur Park, and Hollenbeck Park, and Reseda later on when they put in the lake there. And they it was just a wonderful place, and my grandfather developed the mahogany boats, the motor boats. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah, I do.
And I didn't realize the same person had all those.
Yeah.
go ahead, Stephen.
No. I remember fondly. I was but a small child, very small.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anne. I appreciate you sharing about your family's involvement in that. 866-893-KPECC. The piers you were mentioning, the Pike in Long Beach, which
right.
later became the New Pike.
Right after the war.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to improve its reputation.
That's how they advertised it when I was a kid, was
exactly.
to New Pike.
And you, Pike.
Tried to make it family friendly, but it still had the sort of tattoo parlor, bars.
Sailors and hookers.
Yeah. That was the reputation of it. But it was interesting how piers, you know, would try and distinguish themselves. I think it was Lick Pier that had the big ballroom
right.
and Lawrence Welk.
Right,
and
the Aragon Ballroom.
Yeah, yeah. So they were trying to set themselves apart from the more tawdry image.
And then when Disneyland was so successful, that opened in 1955, the next year, Charles Straub and the producer, Hal Roach, who produced Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang, they own the L.A. Turf Club, which owns Santa Anita. Roy Disney, Walt's brother, went to ABC's. Leonard Goldenson got the money for Disneyland. They went to William Paley at CBS and got the money to buy Ocean Park Pier and redo it. And they in 1958, it opened as Pacific Ocean Park, which for someone my age
is
still one
kid.
Of the holy grails.
That was I actually preferred that to going to Disneyland, crazy as that sounds.
I know.
There was
know.
Something kind of spooky about POP that...
Well, it also, it just sort of, it smelled good, for one thing. You're at the beach, and it looked like the space age. But it was really the poor man's Disneyland. There's no doubt about it. And it never made money.
Yeah,
never.
Went bankrupt pretty quickly.
In 67, it closed.
And eventually burned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's still the pilings there with their signs on the beach warning you about the pilings
right.
for boats or if you're going into the water. If you remember some of these early attractions of Southern California, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Now, what convinced the owners of Universal Studios that people would want to come visit a studio and tour the lot?
It happened first. It was in two stages. From the very beginning, when the studio opened in 1915, there were the Gray Line tours. And they would come, and for 25 cents, you could go in and get a see a movie being shot and get a chicken lunch. But then when the sound came in, the tourists made too much noise, so they killed off the tourists. That was the end of it. Well, Lou Wasserman in the 60s saw how much money Walt Disney was making at Disneyland and thought maybe it's time to bring back the pier and the tour. And originally they aligned with Grey Line, and they thought, why should we do that? We can keep all the money. And they actually hired a Disney artists to come up with a welcoming pavilion and what they called glamour trams to take you through the sound stages. And very quickly, they were earning profits of $1 million a year from the tour. But you would only stay on the lot so long, and then the tourists would end up going to Disneyland. So they said, well, why don't we add a stunt show? Why don't we maybe add a ride? And then came Steven Spielberg. Why don't we add a shark? Why don't we add dinosaurs?
King Kong.
Yes, right. And you now have a real rival to Disney with Harry Potter at the Universal Parks.
And, of course, they had the amphitheater for many years with concerts all
right.
summer long. And then once right. they put the roof on it all year long,
right.
Which gave way for the Harry Potter.
They got rid of the arena.
Yeah. Oh, Lisa wants to talk about one of my boyhood favorites. Lisa in Rancho Palos Verdes. Go right ahead.
Yeah, there used to be a small amusement park on Beverly Boulevard where Cedars-Sinai Hospital is now.
Beverly Park and the pony rides next door.
Right. Actually, and it's the Beverly Center is there now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And the owner consulted with Walt Disney, went to Europe, and came back and gave Walt some ideas for Disneyland.
Lisa, do you remember the little roller coaster that they had at Beverly Park? It was the scale of it. It was almost laughable now, but as a kid, I thought it was the coolest thing.
Oh, I loved it. I loved that park so much. It was so much fun to go to.
And what was nice, too, is you could do kids' birthday parties there, and it was much more affordable, you know, for working-class families like mine who, you know, going to Disneyland was just not something we could really afford. But Beverly
Park
was affordable.
And it was so close to Beverly Hills that all the divorced fathers, it's where they would take their kids on weekends.
Right. Hey, Paul in Glendale, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I was just telling the producer that when I was a kid in the 50s, my dad would take me to Disneyland every before Christmas, because before Christmas you could actually get on rides back then. But we took a helicopter from the Sepulveda Dam down to Disneyland. There was a service, an old Army air helicopter with open doors that you could take down there, and we did that three times.
Wow.
It ended when there was I hate to say it, but there was a crash, and that was the end of
there
helicopter
was a crash.
Service.
There was no guards on it at all. So we just watched all those swimming pools go by underneath us.
Oh, my goodness. What a thrill ride before you'd even get to Disneyland. Paul, thank you. Appreciate your sharing that. Fluton wants to bring up Pacific Ocean Park. You bet. POP.
Pay one price.
Yeah, yeah. Yvonne wondering when those ostrich farms went away. What killed off the ostrich farms?
Lack of interest. The alligator farm held on in Lincoln Park until the 50s. It moved right across the street from Knott's Berry Farm, which we haven't even talked about.
That was there in the 60s. And, of course, what Walter and Cordelia Knott did with Knott's Berry Farm, their restaurant, which is still there.
Yes.
And the Old West feel of it, which, of course, now it's much more of a Magic Mountain-like kind
Correct.
Of ride-centric experience. Stephen, thanks so much.
Larry,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Stephen M. Silverman, the amusement park, 900 years of thrills and spills, and the dreamers and schemers who built them. Much more to come in our second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. And coming up later this hour, superstitions. What are the odd beliefs that we hold, even if we don't really believe that they have a hold on our luck? What are the things we do out of force or of habit, or maybe just to hedge our bets a bit? We'll open up the phones. That's a little bit later this hour. But first, we turn our attention to the 2020 presidential race, and specifically
African-American voters. Black voters are a huge part of the Democratic Party vote and will be key figures in deciding who the Democratic nominee is going to be. In fact, our California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris is putting much of her emphasis in these early days on South Carolina and its large African-American base of voters. But with us to talk about what polls show are the issues most important to black voters, what the regional differences are and what black voters say, and about what they're looking for in a candidate is Guy Molyneux, who's a partner at Hart Research Associates. He led a team that conducted polling for the Black Economic Alliance. Thank you, Mr. Molyneux, for joining us. First of all, have we seen over time much of a shift in the issues that are of greatest importance to black voters?
Well, I think that the importance of economic issues does vary a bit over time. That was the focus of this research, was really understanding the economic priorities of African Americans across the country and what they want to hear from candidates in the presidential election next year on that front. We heard a lot from them about the importance of jobs, both creating good jobs, but also helping African Americans get the skills and training they need to succeed in the workplace. What may be a bit newer is also a lot of emphasis on access to credit and access to capital, whether that's mortgage to buy a home or a loan to start a small business. I think that is an area of growing importance in the black community.
So the respondents to your survey indicated that perhaps ways of easing access to home ownership or small business loans or things like that?
Exactly right. They told us that it was a very high priority for them to see policies and programs that would increase home ownership, small business creation, and more broadly help people in the black community to build wealth. So concern about sort of improved incomes in terms of employment opportunities, but also building wealth in the community.
One of the things interesting is that this survey of 30,000 African-American voters shows displeasure with the Democratic Party generally in serving the needs and interests of black voters. And do you know if that's distinctly different than how black voters felt about the party in the past, or has that feeling of being underserved been consistent?
I think you're addressing a different survey there. Our survey of 1,000 African Americans did not specifically ask them to assess how the party was serving the interests of black Americans. We did ask them about their view of most of the leading Democratic candidates for president, as well as President Trump, but we did not ask them about the party.
We're talking with Guy Molyneux of Hart Research Associates, conducting a survey for the Black Economic Alliance. And I particularly like to hear from African-American listeners to Air Talk. What are some of the issues that you think candidates really need to be focused on that are of particular interest to black voters? And maybe this isn't just from you, but conversations with your family members, with African-American friends. Maybe you're involved with a church or community groups that are heavily African-American. And some of the issues that come up that you think are distinctly of high priority to you and others in your community. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. I'm also interested in hearing your thoughts about how the different candidates are addressing those issues. As I mentioned, Kamala Harris is really putting a lot of her eggs into the South Carolina primary basket, seeing that really the path for her to the nomination isn't likely going to go through Iowa, not likely to be built in New Hampshire, but with the large black electorate of South Carolina, that's going to be critical for her to distinguish herself in the very large field of Democratic candidates. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Guy Molyneux, also wanted to ask you about which candidates are black voters seemingly most comfortable with?
Well, at this point, the one they express the most comfort seeing in the White House is Joe Biden. Three quarters of African Americans say they would be either comfortable or even enthusiastic about seeing him become president, and that's among the Democrats, the ones who might actually play a role in the primaries. That rises to 80%, and then still within those who are Democrats, you have Bernie Sanders in second place at 64% feeling that way, and then Kamala Harris, 52% feel comfortable or enthusiastic about seeing her become president. I should just put that all in context, that only 9% of African Americans would be comfortable seeing Donald Trump back in the White House in 2021. So huge gap between him and all the Democratic contenders, obviously. But at this point, I think you'd have to say that those three, Harris, Sanders, and Biden, are at the top, with Cory Booker sort of one step below as well. But what's interesting is some of the difference between Harris and Biden and Sanders is she is still not as well known nationally,
Mm-hmm.
Having never run nationally the way the others have. When we look only at African Americans who say they're familiar with each of these candidates, then Kamala Harris is essentially viewed equally as Bernie Sanders. About two-thirds of African Americans in both cases say I'd be comfortable with them being president. Former Vice President Biden still is a step ahead of them, with 80% saying they'd be comfortable with him.
And what's your sense of, I mean, I don't know if you get into this issue, how much of the comfort with Biden is the fact that he was Barack Obama's vice president?
That's a fascinating question, and it wasn't one that this particular survey was designed to answer. I think, you know, just any Democratic vice president, two terms, there would probably be, you know, a pretty good comfort level with African-American voters with someone like that, even if they had not served under the nation's first black president. But it certainly seems likely that service, that connection to Obama, probably helps him even beyond simply having been the nation's vice president for 8 years.
Let me again just refresh the call. African-American listeners to Air Talk, I'm very interested in your thoughts about what you think African-American voters are going to prioritize most in your conversations with family members, with friends who are black, with those that you talk about political or social issues. What is your sense of what are the biggest issues? If you don't detect a difference from any other group of Democrats, that's great too. I'd be happy to hear that. But if there are particular issues that you think come to the fore in black communities across the country, or even you see regional district. Maybe you have family that lives elsewhere, and you know things they're concerned about are different than what you're thinking as an Angeleno. I'd be interested in hearing about that. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael in Alhambra says, I want to hear where the candidates stand on reparations. Native Americans got reparations. Japanese Americans got reparations in internment camps. Is that something that candidates are seriously going to talk about? Gene in Mid-City, L.A. says, cut the check now. I care about reparations. 866-893-KPECC. Guy, did you poll on that subject?
I'm sorry, which
reparations for African Americans?
Yes, we did. We did ask about that. Black Americans do believe that reparations should be paid. We found that 65% said that they thought that those who can trace their ancestry to slaves should receive reparations. I would not say that it is at the absolute top of the priorities. We find that 49% of African Americans say that is something that would help improve economic conditions a great deal. That's the sort of strongest positive answer that we provided for some of these actions. So you have 49% there. In comparison, 72% said that increasing the federal minimum wage would help the black community a great deal. So I think that, you know, expanding training programs, 68%, strengthening laws against employment discrimination, 69%. So in comparison, reparations seems to be a ways down the agenda compared to lots of other ideas that candidates are likely to be talking about. But at the same time, a clear majority does favor that policy.
We're talking with Guy Molyneux, who's partner Hart Research Associates. He led the research, the polling done for the Black Economic Alliance, which is an organization that advocates on a number of different issues economically, as this title indicates. Leah Wright-Rigor is Associate Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University, author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics, and The Pursuit of Power. Professor Rigor, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So historically, have you seen much of a shift in what are the election priorities of Black voters?
You know, not necessarily. So I think what people rank in terms of top five tends to fluctuate. But there are a couple of things that are constant, namely ideas about the economy, ideas about wealth, ideas about growth, including social mobility and capital. So that has been pretty consistent, but also the idea of cost of living and affordability. So over the years, you know, we've seen African Americans increasingly point to the cost of healthcare or healthcare more generally as a really significant issue. We've seen issues like the cost of housing and affordability. We've seen issues around the cost of college and education and affordability rise up the ranks. But in terms of kind of this overarching idea of Black economics, that has been pretty consistent in terms of what African Americans see as the pressing or among the most pressing issues politically within the United States.
And are there issues that are highly divisive among Black voters? I'm wondering, for example, if certain social issues might be, as they are in the general population, divisive. Do you see that among African American voters, or are they highly aligned in pretty much every category?
No. African-American voters tend to be aligned across the board on, you know, a number of different issues. Where we do start to see breakdown or differences, that generally comes out based on generational issues, gendered issues, And then, of course, regional issues. So somebody who is located in Mississippi might have a different view of somebody who a very different view of a social policy from somebody who is located in California. Somebody who is 18 years old, for example, might have a more more lenient view of socialism than somebody who is 65 years old and lives in South Carolina. So we do see these kind of important variations, but in terms of significant divisive issues, not the amount that we see interracially. We're not seeing these kind of intra-racial divisive issues.
What about religion? I don't have numbers in front of me, but my sense is African Americans are more religiously affiliated on average than the general population. And so I wonder, does expression of faith among candidates matter to Black voters?
So African Americans, you're absolutely right. African Americans exhibit higher rates of religiosity than other Black Americans, than other racial groups, although that is beginning to change amongst younger generations. So younger generations are still religious, although they are not necessarily connected to the church in the same way that older generations are and were. But what we do see in some respects are that there are some significant differences or significant points of departure. So, for example, there are a couple of surveys from Gen Forward a few years ago that found that African-Americans were, a subset of African-Americans, were a bit more conservative on issues surrounding LGBTQ issues. That they do have, you know, there are some points where they were concerned about candidates and issues of surrounding faith and religion. With that said, one of the really interesting things about Black voters is their ability to compartmentalize how they feel about certain issues and connect it and vote for candidates. So what we see in a number of different, you know, particularly at the presidential election level or the national level, is that an African-American voter may be completely at odds with the social policy of his or her preferred candidate. What they do is they compartmentalize that and they still vote for their preferred Democratic candidate, even though that's a religious policy, you know, their religious preferences may be out of whack with that candidate. So that's something really interesting and nuanced about how Black voters, you know, how they actually vote.
We're talking with Harvard professor Leah Wright-Rigor, associate professor of public policy at Harvard and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. The professor will continue with us. And our thanks to pollster Guy Molyneux of Hart Research Associates, conducted a poll released yesterday by the Black Economic Alliance. You're listening to Where Talk. We're going to hear from African-American listeners, their priorities, and beyond that, their sense of family members or African-American friends, what they see as some of the different issues that come to the fore, as well as what they're looking for in Democratic candidates. 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. African-American voters are a significant portion of the Democratic Party's base. Their votes are going to be key for the candidates seeking the presidential nomination. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our focus on African-American voters. California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris is banking big on a strong show of support for her in South Carolina. She's having more problems actually in California than favorite daughter candidate, so to speak. I guess that'd be the play on favorite son candidate, might be expected to have, as she is in fourth place in the most recent UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies poll done for the Los Angeles Times. It just came out. Joe Biden leading that, with he being the first choice candidate for about 22%. Elizabeth Warren stands at about 17. Bernie Sanders just under Warren. And then Kamala Harris, first choice candidate for just about 14-15% of voters, and everybody else trails them. might be a little surprising to think, because, of course, Kamala Harris's profile is highest here as she's the junior senator in California. Before that, of course, being attorney general, and before that, district attorney in San Francisco. We're at 866-893-KPCC, and we're talking with Black listeners of Air Talk to get your sense of what candidates need to do to appeal across the spectrum of African-American voters. Deborah in Encino, good to have you with us. What are the issues that you're most wanting to hear talked about by the candidate you're willing to support?
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Well, I'm actually supporting Elizabeth Warren. I think she's got the most substantive platform of all the candidates. And what's most important to me, I'm a longtime Democratic voter, but I think the African-American community really needs access to capital to start small businesses. I am a native Angeleno. I'm actually from the neighborhood that Nipsey Hussle is from. And when you go and look at that corner of Crenshaw and Slauson, it's just, very underdeveloped, and it really needs a big influx of capital, and I'd like to see those being Black-owned businesses specifically, because I think when you have Black-owned businesses, they employ Black people, and those people tend to go to school and pay taxes, and you have a lower crime rate, and that makes our communities much stronger. So I'd certainly like to see access to capital. I'd also like to see decriminalization of marijuana and African-Americans be a part of the vast financial upside to being in the local legal marijuana business. So I'm really looking for business access to business opportunities.
So, Deborah, you see Elizabeth Warren, at least at this point, as the candidate you think is most committed to that or would be able to deliver that most. Do you have any pause with Kamala Harris also running, being an African-American woman, or do you feel like the issues really supersede the issue of her race?
Well, I don't think Kamala has strong policies. I don't think her policies are as strong as Elizabeth Warren's policies are. You know, by being the former Attorney General of California, I would certainly love to see her, come out with a decriminalization of marijuana. That would be a really, a really big platform, I think, for her to take on. And I really haven't heard her say much at all about that.
All right.
But I dislike her. I like her more than I do Biden, but certainly Elizabeth Warren at this point is my favorite.
Deborah, I really appreciate it. Now, in conversations, I don't know how close you are to your family members. You said you grew up here in L.A. I don't know if you have any of your family that's in other parts of the country or whatever. You talk politics a lot, and is there much variety among your friend group or family members about preferred candidate?
Yeah, we talk about politics a lot. And I've got relatives that like Biden, unfortunately. and I have relatives that like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. So we're kind of all across the board.
All right. All right.
Early. And it's good that I think the Democrats have a lot of candidates in the fray right now, because we get all kinds of new ideas. I even like Andrew Yang and his freedom dividend. I think that's a strong policy. So it's good that we have so many to choose from in all of these platforms that we can, investigate and hopefully come up with the best candidate. And whoever we do have, I will strongly support them as opposed to President Trump.
Deborah, thank you so much. Deborah in Encino. Let's talk with Bradley in Anaheim. So, Bradley, what do you most want to hear from candidates?
Oh, thank you, Larry. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good to have you with us.
Looking most for the candidates is specific plans. In fact, Deborah mentioned right nail on the head, like Andrew Yang. There's a number of candidates that have very clear-cut plans in regard to domestic policies, but I'm also looking for international policies, roughly. I know it's early, but it's still good to kind of show that you have that spectrum as a candidate. And then also, when it comes to what they're kind of bringing up right now, I really do consider it a pandering season right now until we really can get into the swing of the elections and some candidates are dropping out. But looking for basically recognition within the Black community of the history of our atrocities. And it continues even today, the justice reform, things like that, showing that they're willing to take that extra step to challenge the status quo on how we should, you know, hopes and prayers when things happen and things like that. You know, it's really a really concise, clear showing that they kind of see that we are coming from a different position culturally within the country than most other cultures.
Bradley, how much do you factor, if at all, the race of the candidate? Would that be at all a difference maker, or is your decision a strictly based on the individual and that person's policies?
The race does play a fair amount, only because the cultural background and experience as well. Because we all understand race does play differently when how we grew up culturally. That's really just how it's defined in America here. But as long as the plan is solid as well, because you can be the same race and have a weak plan, and I'm not going to vote for you.
Okay, Bradley, I appreciate it. In Anaheim, let's talk with Daniel in Santa Ana. Daniel, what's the biggest issue for you as you look at the presidential candidates?
Criminal justice reform, sentencing reform, bail reform, marijuana rescheduling. The criminal justice system, I believe, is the biggest detriment in our community. We need to address that.
Okay. So, Daniel, in your conversations, again, I don't know if you have family members you talk politics with, but you know, is there a lot of variety in the points of view of African-Americans in your world?
Oh, absolutely. I went to Howard Law in D.C., and you know, we're all over the place. I got a lot of my colleagues believe it could be it's a personal detriment. So we're all over the place. But I believe that Biden has the best chance of defeating Trump and addressing these issues.
Daniel, appreciate it. In Santa Ana, let me go back to Harvard professor Leah Wright-Rigor, assistant professor of public policy. What's your sense of what's going to galvanize Black turnout in the various states' primaries? What do you think is really going to drive people to come out?
Well, when we look at what drives people to come out, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into this. So they're looking for a candidate. You know, Black voters, among other things, are pragmatic, and they really are looking for a candidate that they feel confident in, you know, believing that this is somebody who could win. This is somebody who could defeat Trump. So that does go, and there are a lot of, you know, factors that go into that. But they're also looking for, and this is particularly true of Black women, they are looking for candidates who have agendas that explicitly speak to Black wants and needs. And in this respect, you know, Black voters are like any other demographic group of voters. They want to know that politicians actually care about them in substantive and sincere ways. So, you know, does this candidate have, you know, an agenda, a policy agenda, have an initiative, have an outline, have actual concrete policies that are going to affect people's day-to-day lived experiences on the ground? Is this candidate going to be a fighter? Is this candidate going to address the issues that I have argued are most pressing? And are they going to do it in a nuanced and really robust fashion? That is absolutely what Black voters are looking for going into the primary season.
Professor, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Leah Wright-Rigor, Harvard University Associate Professor of Public Policy, and she's author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics, and the Pursuit of Power. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and our next segment was actually proposed by Hetty Lynn Hurdies, looking at people's unusual superstitions. We'll open up the phones to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC. Now time for an update from sometime producer Hetty Lynn Hurdies.
Let us
Superstitions, very common in the world of professional sports, but just in daily life for many of us. And as I mentioned, Hedy Lyn Hurdy stopped me in the hall the other day and said, you know, people have so many different superstitions, some of them quite odd. It'd be fun to hear from listeners as to their superstitions. So if you have one that's particularly offbeat, I don't mean like, you know, just knocking on wood when you say something, but something that's peculiar, I'd like to hear about it. Or if you have a close family member with a highly unusual superstition, please share it with us right now. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. I invited A. Martinez to join me because A. is an expert on baseball. He was the host for many years of the Dodgers pre- and post-game show, as well as for the Lakers shows on ESPN LA. And athletes are notorious, for superstitions.
Oh, baseball players especially. Yeah, I was around the Dodgers for 10 years. And here's the thing. From February 14th, that's right around the time where pitchers and catchers report spring training, all the way through the end of the season, it could be somewhere in October, you've got around 250 straight days of work where these guys are with each other all the time. So what they do, because it's such a daily thing, baseball is, they develop habits and patterns that they want to repeat as often as possible. And this way, if something goes amiss, if they're in a slump, they can identify something maybe that was different in the routine and try to work on it. So baseball players, I know hockey players are very superstitious as well, but baseball is an everyday event. So they develop these routines and these superstitions to help them get through it.
And it's really tricky is the other thing, mm-hmm. Because baseball players, it's often hard for them to determine why all of a sudden the baseball, you know, looks like a grapefruit as opposed to it looking like a BB. And so much of it is difficult for players themselves to understand why they've gotten hot or cold. It makes sense they're trying to look for an outside pattern to explain it.
Yeah, that way if everything's the same, typically they can identify the one thing that may have been different. Maybe they had a pickle in their hamburger and all of a sudden tomorrow they won't have a pickle because that pickle made them go 0-for-4 that night with 4 strikeouts.
I love where you'll hear a pitcher describe, I went this particular route to the ballpark from home and threw a shutout. So, you know, the next time they take the same
exact
route.
Wade Boggs.
Oh, used to eat chicken. Great hitter.
Used to eat chicken before every single game and he'd take batting practice at 5:17 every single night. Every single night, same thing.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Paul, in the city of industry, what is the superstition you've been exposed to?
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Paul. I'm of Spanish and Italian descent, but my wife is Chinese. We're in the middle of renovations in our home. My father-in-law, her father, is a contractor, and he instantly stopped working and refuses to work on our home because of a Chinese superstition that you are not to do construction or hammer any nails or anything while a woman is pregnant in the home.
Really? How interesting that would disturb the pregnancy?
Yes. The idea is, I think from what I've been told, that the spirit of the child will try to attempt to help the parents, and that the spirit energy may get harmed in the construction process.
Fascinating. So are you holding off on doing the renovation?
Well, unfortunately, we're stuck in the kitchen. I've been told that we can, say some prayers and do some things. So we're going to try to convince our father to allow us to go through those rituals and perhaps continue forward with the much needed renovations.
Yeah, has your wife weighed in on this, or is she feeling leery of you guys working on the house while she's pregnant?
Well, you know, she doesn't really follow the Buddhist traditions of her family. She's a first generation American, so they're a little more detached from.
Okay, but respectful of her dad, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, Paul, thank you. I appreciate the call. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And Paul bringing up, and it's great we do this in Los Angeles, hey, the sort of multicultural things that come from different traditions or religious backgrounds, which you don't even necessarily know unless you marry someone of that background.
And when that kid is born, it's going to be so noisy anyway. Just start hammering away. The second that kid comes out.
It's funny. Kristen gets on me whenever I'll say, like, we're on the way, so I say, boy, traffic is so great. It's unusually good
why
this time.
Why did you even say it out loud?
Why did you say that?
You should totally know better, Larry.
Yeah, this show is going so great, by the way. Eh? Oh. So what? Oh, no.
We got how
you
much time? Yeah, here we go.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk next with Sue in Koreatown. You're on AirTalk.
Hi there. My superstition is that if I write my name or anyone else's name in red ink, they'll, so to speak, be cursed. So I remember as a kid, my mom would always prevent me from writing my name in red ink so that I don't have a bad day, as she would tell me. And now, even now as an adult, I still avoid writing my name or anyone else's name in red ink, just so they don't have a bad day or they're not cursed.
Wow. And so what's the background of your mother, where she came up with this idea?
You know what? It really started with, like, my grandparents who are Korean. My mom is also Korean. And we just, I don't know if it's an Asian thing, but I know certainly in my family you just never write anyone's name in red ink.
Well, at least that's an easy one to adhere to, right, Sue? So that's great. So
I remember.
Well, hold on. I got to take more calls, but I appreciate it so much. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We have another Korean-American listener from West Hollywood. Yuni, what's one in your family?
Well, my mom always taught me that, like, if you're dating somebody, you never buy them a pair of shoes because that means they're going to run away from you in those shoes. And so I've never ever bought a partner a pair of shoes.
All right. I love it. Has anyone bought you a pair of shoes that you told them, no, you got to take these back, I can't accept them?
Oh, no, it only works. Fine, I've definitely received plenty of shoes.
Oh, okay, all right. Uni in West Hollywood, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Claudia in South Pasadena, you have one from the theater you want to share.
Well, actually, I hate all of them, like the Scottish play, but the one that really drives me nuts is the break a leg thing.
Yeah.
Wish me luck. I can take it. We had this one play.
Oh.
It was the last night. And this gal that was working behind the scenes went around, break a leg, break. And then we had an after party. And somebody spilled some champagne. She did not break her leg when she slipped in it, but she badly sprained her knee, which I kind of thought was poetic justice.
Oh, Claudia, oh, no. All right, so no break a leg. All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org.
But if she hadn't have said break a leg, she probably would have broken the leg.
Yeah.
That's the thing. At least it just a sprain.
Yeah, you're not going to say sprain a knee.
You say it out loud, and then it doesn't happen.
So, hey, do you have any superstitions?
1:30, 30 minutes before. Before take two, I brush my teeth. I have to start the show with a clean mouth.
And is that to the minute or you?
1:30.
It's got
to be at 1:30, half an hour before. I mean, technically, it would be 1:36. Our show starts 6 minutes after the hour.
Right,
so I guess I could adjust it if I wanted to, but 1:30.
Does that practice go back to when you started in radio?
Yeah, half an hour before every show I've ever done. When I was doing Dodger Talk, I'd be on right after the show, so right before I'd come up from the field, I'd hit the restroom and brush my teeth and then get on the air.
All right. So what's your superstition as an AirTalk listener, particularly if it's an offbeat one? I want to hear if you have an unusual one from your family. Maybe it's a family member or a friend that has it. Share it with us. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jack in Zurich says dolls, handmade dolls, will not have them in my house ever. Dates back to a kind of hoodoo thing from my youth. No creepy dolls. All right, Jack. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Take Two, Zay Martinez, apparently not the only person with the teeth brushing superstition. You're saying there was a pitcher on the Mets?
Yeah, Turk Wendell, when he was a starting pitcher, he was both a reliever and a starter, but when he got starts, after he'd pitch an inning, he'd go down to the dugout and brush his teeth in the sink that every dugout has, and then he'd go out there for the next inning with a clean mouth.
with
glistening
teeth.
I don't know how that helps him, but...
8-6 and good for on-the-mound visits with the catcher.
I suppose so, yeah.
866-893-KPCC. We're talking superstitions. Belinda writes on the page, I have a pathological fear of naming favorites aloud, favorite color, food, movie, certain in the knowledge as soon as I utter the words, evil puff of smoke will appear, take away all the other options. All right,
oh,
Belinda. 866. Norma says, my mom ingrained in me never turn a calendar too early. Like, don't show January when it's still December. I don't know what bad things would happen. But Diane in Irvine, I understand you have a Russian background. And so what's the superstition you were exposed to?
So if somebody gave either an evil eye or if somebody supposedly looks at you feeling jealous, you're supposed to wipe your face in your underpants that you are wearing.
Really? Wow.
Wait, wipe your face with the underpants?
With your underpants.
Wow.
That you're...
Yes. And it all, in our family, my parents were in their engagement party, and my grandmother spotted a woman looking at them kind of sideways, and she told my mom, all right, go get Sammy to wipe his face. And my mom had not let my dad know about this, so she was chasing him around till he finally relented.
So he had to, what, go in the restroom, take his underpants on, wipe his face with?
Whatever way you can do it.
Okay. All right. Wow. Diane, 866-893-KPECC. Janelle in Long Beach, what's your unusual superstition?
Well, in healthcare, you never refer to a day being quiet or slow. And then if you are having like a crazy shift in the evening, it's always because it's a full moon.
All right. Yeah. I've heard that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk next with Alex in Loma Linda. I understand you're of Iraqi background. What was the superstition you were exposed to?
Hi. Yeah. In Iraq, there's the saying or the myth, if you were to sneeze one time, it's a confirmation, or it could be also a delay. You should not embark on whatever you are going to embark on. And I remember my brother back in the 70s, where planes were not as, safe as today.
Yeah.
So he sneezed one time, and he didn't get on the plane because of that. But if you were to sneeze twice, then it is
you're free to go.
To go ahead and do it.
That's so funny. Alex, sharing that superstition from Iraq, 866-893-KPCC. Chad in Irvine, what's your superstition?
So every time before I get in the car, I go and tap my left front tire.
Why?
With my foot. You know, when I was younger, I did that once with one of my toy motor cars, and underneath the front left tire was a $20 bill. So every time I get in the car, I do it once, just hopefully for good luck.
That's funny. But it's never, the cash has never reappeared.
No, unfortunately not.
All right, Chad. 866-893-KPECC.
But it might.
Yeah, you
it
never
might.
Know.
Just do it, right?
You never know. Barney in Marina del Rey, you've got some superstitions from Brazil from when you were in the Peace Corps?
Yes, deep in the last century, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Brazil, and I started a housing construction project. One of the superstitions is we were not allowed to make bricks for the houses during a new moon.
Why was that?
Who knows?
Just bad luck.
That's the expression. It's bad for you. And another was after you drink a cup of coffee, you may not drink ice water.
Interesting. And what did they give a reason for that?
It's Fajmal. It's bad for you.
All right. Barney, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC. Hey, do you have any other athlete superstitions at the ready?
Well, the one that I would do when I was pitching in high school and college is that I would never touch the chalk. The baseball field is lined with chalk. I'd make sure I avoided touching the chalk with my feet, with my shoes, with the glove, any way I could avoid the chalk. It didn't really do much because I didn't make it to the big leagues, Larry, but at least I believed that I was doing everything possible to be as ready as possible.
And it's neater, certainly. So yeah. If you're running off the mound, off the field, did you kind of stutter step?
No,
or
hop.
Okay, very, you actually hopped over the line.
To make sure that no chalk could come up and bite me somehow.
Wow. Did you, when you were playing at, particularly, you were Cal State Northridge, right?
Or LA City College, that's where I played, yeah.
Yeah. Did you and your teammates talk much about superstitions, or do people keep it to themselves?
But you'd see it, because you'd notice something that didn't look quite right, and that was that guy's thing, and you left them alone, and you made sure that no one got in that person's way, and everyone respected each other. That's the thing about baseball, too. And there's a great movie called Bull Durham. Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, Nuke LaLoosh, played by Tim Robbins, and Susan Sarandon's in it, too. And Tim Robbins' character wears lingerie before he pitches. And he believes it makes him pitch better. And Kevin Costner was saying that, hey, you know what? That's the whole point of it. If you believe you're winning because you're wearing lingerie, then you are. And I think a lot of superstitions are based in that if you do it, you're as prepared for the day as you need to be. Then you are. You've convinced yourself.
In recent years, we've seen the rise of facial hair, which also seems, some players say they're not going to shave for
hockey
a given
players,
period.
Yeah,
hockey players. And of course, there is the crusty, scuzzy cap that some players, do not change their cap.
Clayton Kershaw, when the playoffs begin, the caps, it's normally brand new caps that have all the playoff logos on them. His cap is the same. They stitch on the logo on the old crusty cap. Watch. The Dodgers are going to make the playoffs again, so just watch for his cap. It'll be as sweaty and yucky as possible.
Oh, that's so funny. Let's see. Next, we have Colleen in Los Alamitos. Real quickly, your superstition.
Hi, my name is Colleen, and I'm Irish. And when I was 18, I was getting married in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I was in the middle of winter, sitting in a room with all my aunts, opening gifts right before the wedding. This was kind of like a late shower. And people were coming in the front door. It was snowing. It was ice cold outside. All of a sudden, this great, big, huge dog, stray dog, ran into the room. Everybody screamed, jumped up, ran around. My Irish grandma said, oh, no, 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 this is the Irish. This is good luck. This is good luck.
That's so funny. Everybody thought bad luck with the dog, but it was good luck. Hey, thanks so much.
Man.
It's a lot of fun. You can share your unusual superstition on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Have a great afternoon.